Today on the podcast, we have a peculiar story about Peter the Great, the Tsar of Russia, and a meeting that he had with some British dignitaries aboard a ship in Holland. Welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast, shipmates. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres. And today I've got a great story for you called Peter the Great. Before we jump into today's tale, just a quick word from our sponsor. Peter the Great, or The Audience in the Main Top. Among the illustrious men whose names are recorded in adamantine characters on the pages of history, there is probably no one more remarkable in many points of view, or who is more entitled to the admiration of mankind for the vigor of his intellect, for the energy of his character, for the unbending firmness with which he prosecuted his designs, for the variety and profundity of his knowledge, and for the zeal and wisdom which characterized his purposes to promote the happiness of his people, than the powerful, despotic Tsar of Russia, Peter the First, surnamed, with propriety, the Great. When, still quite a youth, he ascended the throne of that vast empire, he found the country distracted by factions and impoverished by civil and foreign wars. He was called upon to govern a barbarous people, among whom the arts and sciences were almost unknown, and who, bound to their separate chiefs or nobles by ties of interest or self-preservation, were but little accustomed to venerate the actual monarch who occupied a tottering throne. Peter was young when he was first vested with the sovereign power. His education had been purposely neglected. His mind had never been disciplined, nor his intellect improved. He had led a life of idleness and pleasure, and had associated only with the ignorant and dissolute, giving free scope to his animal passions. But when he unexpectedly found himself enthroned in the palace of the Tsars, a sudden and mighty change seemed to have been effected in his character. The energies and powers of his mind, which till then had lain dormant, were called into action. He was aware of the responsibility of his situation as the head of a vast and populous empire, and resolved for that moment to devote himself to the improvement and happiness of his subjects, to introduce radical reforms into the customs and manners of the people and into the departments of the state and the church. He was aware that, to succeed in his undertaking, he had formidable obstacles to overcome, and he wisely commenced the great work by improving his own education and reforming himself. He applied himself assiduously to the study of military tactics and political economy, and at the same time gained, apparently with little effort, a knowledge of the German, French, and English languages, and by the free distribution of honors and rewards, encouraged important improvements in the mechanic arts, and in the more difficult sciences. He labored also to restore peace to his distracted country, and above all, to repress and prevent all intestine commotions, by elevating the condition of the peasantry and restricting the colossal power of the boyards, landholders of princely rank, who had previously often rebelled against the sovereign power. Owing to his unremitting industry, and the force of a powerful intellect, aided by an indomitable will, he was in a great measure successful, and after he had restored comparative tranquility to his domain, he resolved to visit other countries and witness the blessings of civilization and gain a thorough practical knowledge of various mechanic arts, and thus prepare himself for instructing his subjects in matters calculated to strengthen the government, promote industry, and contribute to the elevation and happiness of all classes. Accordingly, having made the necessary arrangements for the due administration of the laws during a long absence, in the year 1697, in the 26th year of his age, he commenced his travels in quest of useful practical knowledge and mingled in the suite of his ambassadors without any personal attendance, excepting a secretary, a valet de chambre, and a favorite dwarf. The ambassadeur, composed in all of about 200 persons, passed through Livonia, which then belonged to Sweden, through Prussia, the confines of Germany, to Holland, and was everywhere received with hospitality and great marks of respect. Some of the ambassadors and princes in the train were clad in vestments of extraordinary magnificence, but the Tsar himself was habited in a plain German costume. He entered Amsterdam some days before the embassy and took private lodgings. A few days afterwards, arrayed in a costume of a mechanic, he visited the village of Saardam, situated on the Zuider Zee, a few miles from the capital, where shipbuilding was at the time carried on a large scale. At this period, the Dutch were celebrated for the excellence of their ships, possessing a formidable navy and engaged in extensive commerce to every part of the globe. It was at Saardam that Peter commenced his labors as a mechanic. He put himself under the orders of a master workman, associated with the carpenters, lodged with them, and worked with them, doing his part in labors of every description. He thus acquired in a short time a practical knowledge of the art of shipbuilding. He worked also in the blacksmith's shop, blew the bellows, and handled the sledgehammer. He aided in the rope walks and gained all necessary information respecting the manufacture of cordage, and passed some of his time in laboring in the sawmills, where he became familiar with the art of sawing timber by machinery. He also gained instruction in the arts of manufacturing paper and working the ductile metals, etc. When Peter commenced his mechanical labors, the shipbuilders were not a little astonished at finding the sovereign of a mighty empire voluntarily enrolling himself in the list of workmen. They were, at first, inclined to treat him with the ceremony and respect due to his exalted station. This feeling of reverence, however, wore off, and they soon learned to regard him as one of their own number, and he was known among them by a familiar appellation, Peterbos, or Master Peter. While at Saardam, the Tsar caused a ship of 60 guns to be built for himself, and superintended the work, and subsequently sent her to Archangel, the only seaport which he then possessed in the north. For the city of St. Petersburg he caused to be built several years afterwards. He resided a short time in Amsterdam to gain a knowledge of the art of surgery, and studied with the celebrated anatomist Ruysch, and also received instruction in medicine from a distinguished physician in Amsterdam. While residing in Holland, Peter did not neglect the public interests of his own country. While handling the compass and the saw at Saardam, he was maturing schemes which had a mighty influence on the destinies of Poland, and from his humble workshop he sent despatches promising to aid Augustus, Elector of Saxony, with 30,000 men. From the same place he issued orders for the assemblage of a large army in the Ukraine to take grounds against the Turks. Such was Peter the Great of Russia. I only intended to write a paragraph introductory to an incident recorded in the life of this illustrious monarch, the details of which I believe are not generally known to the world, and I find myself insensibly engaged in writing his biography. In common with almost every traveler who has been to Holland, I have seen the village of Saardam and the humble workshops and lodging house of the Tsar, which are still pointed out with manifestations of pride and exaltation by the worthy and hospitable inhabitants. But the village is not now as flourishing as it was in the days of the Tsar. Holland, which at that time was equal to any nation as a maritime power, was woefully degenerated in this respect. England, France, Spain, as well as our own country, are greatly her superior, and Saardam has declined in population, and the enterprise of the inhabitants, in proportion as Holland has declined as a naval power. But still an interest is attached to the place, which makes it an important object in the eyes of travelers, and there one, without being a melancholy Jack, could sit and moralize for hours. But to my story. Peter, as I have already intimated, while working as a carpenter or blacksmith at Sardam, did not endeavor to preserve his incognito. It was soon known to every court in Europe that the Tsar of Russia was residing in Holland, and although the different European monarchs were at that time unable to appreciate his character, as manifested by his voluntary labors and sacrifices of pomp and personal comforts, they respected him as a powerful and energetic head of a mighty empire, and most of the European monarchs sent to him, with much display and ceremony, ambassadors, tendering him with respects and inviting him to visit their respective courts. William of England, however, was dilatory in thus evincing his respect for the Tsar, much to the dissatisfaction of the Russian monarch, who was particularly desirous of being on the most friendly terms with the English king. At length, after waiting impatiently for several months, the Tsar learned with much gratification that King William was about to send three ambassadors, selected from among the most distinguished noblemen and attended by a brilliant cortege, to do honor to Peter of Russia. The Tsar, with a spirit of eccentricity which he not unfrequently exhibited, resolved to teach these envoys a lesson which they would not soon forget, and punish them in a whimsical manner for their tardiness. When the ambassadors reached Amsterdam, they were astonished to learn that Peter was at Sardam, busily engaged in building a ship, which was nearly finished, and that he would be delighted to see them at that place. The English noblemen, who expected to be received at Amsterdam with the pomp and ceremony corresponding to the character of their mission, were not a little embarrassed by this information, but set off post-haste for Sardam to find the carpenter monarch, and sent an avant-courier with despatches announcing their intentions. They reached Sardam at the appointed hour, but to their great surprise were informed that the Tsar was then on board his ship, where he awaited their arrival, and was impatient to give them an audience. They were also informed that a boat was in waiting at the shipyard to put them alongside. The English dignitaries hardly knew what to think of this affair. There were no precedents by which to frame their line of conduct. They were desirous for many reasons to have an interview with the Tsar, and were great sticklers for etiquette. Yet, after a hurried consultation, they determined to flatter the whims of the barbarian monarch and visit him on board his ship. A couple of burly-looking Dutchmen in a large and clumsy boat pulled off the ambassadors and a portion of their suite. They were received at the gangway by a man dressed in the costumes of a sailor who, in a rough manner, welcomed them aboard. Wondering at their singular reception, but supposing it a specimen of Russian manners, they inquired for the Tsar, and their consternation was actually ludicrous when the sailor, with a knowing grin, pointed to the maintop and assured the grave and stately representatives of Albion that Peterbos was aloft, where he expected the pleasure of receiving the ambassadors of his friend and brother, the King of England. The ambassadors were stupefied at this arrangement, and gazed at each other with despairing looks when told that the hall of audience of the Russian monarch was the maintop of a sloop of war. They could not conceal their perplexity and, indeed, entertained some suspicions that they were the victims of a hoax. But when they were assured that the Tsar was actually in the maintop, and wished and expected them to climb the rigging and introduce themselves to his presence, their hearts failed, their limbs trembled, and they hardly knew what course to adopt. "What," said the proud and venerable Earl of Tewkesbury, "does the Tsar of Russia expect me to climb up those rope ladders and play the part of a harlequin at this period of my life? To ascend that crow's nest in such a way would not only be highly undignified in a person of my rank, but actually impossible." "No," said Sir Nicholas Granger, with a spice of indignation, as well as sorrow in his tone, "this is a most unreasonable exaction on the part of the Tsar. For my part," continued the knight, taking a survey of his portly proportions, and then glancing at the shrouds, "I should as soon think of flying as of going aloft in the maintop by means of the rigging. No, if I get there, they must hoist me up by the pulleys." Upon further inquiry, they satisfied themselves that they must visit the bear in his den, elevated as it was, or return to England without accomplishing the object of their mission. They hesitated a few moments, uncertain which horn of the dilemma to seize. But Lord Gower, the youngest of the party, who had once been as far as Constantinople in a ship of war, and who therefore boasted of his nautical experience, suggested that there was nothing so very alarming or dangerous in the Tsar's request, that it was neither a frolic nor a hoax, but a mark of respect to a great maritime government to receive her envoys in a noble ship, and if that they should refuse his invitation to go aloft and hold a personal interview, after having proceeded thus far, the Tsar would construe it into an insult, take umbrage, and a war between the two powers of England and Russia must be the inevitable result. These arguments had due weight, and the other ambassadors, with sour looks and ungracious grunt, at length signified their reluctant assent to the arrangement, and prepared to go up the rigging, a feat which is somehow awkward and difficult, even to a young and active landsman, and was truly appalling to these venerable and heavy-moulded noblemen. It was an act of devotion to their country and their king, of which we can hardly find a parallel in the pages of history. They heroically mounted the gunwale, Lord Gower leading the way, and they were also assisted by the rough, nautical-looking personage who received them at the gangway, and who subsequently proved to be the celebrated Lefort, one of the most faithful and able among the counselors and friends of the Russian monarch. They got upon the ratlings and slowly ascended, panting for breath, and pausing in their career every few moments. They were gazed at with admiration by the crew and officers on the deck of the ship, who could hardly help cheering them in their arduous undertaking. And after rather unreasonable time, they reached, breathless with fatigue, the Cat Harpings, where, clinging convulsively to the footock shrouds, they tarried a while to recover their breath, and consult upon what was next to be done. To climb the footock shrouds and pass over the top rim outside, they, with one voice, decided was impossible, when Lord Gower, with a triumphant shout, pointed out the lubber's hole, of which he had often heard, and the pen is reluctant to record it. These proud representatives of a great kingdom of a power which aimed to become the sovereign of the seas were actually so lost to shame and a sense of true dignity as to crawl into the maintop through the lubber's hole. This fact has never been recorded in the naval annals of Great Britain, or, if it was faithfully recorded at the time it occurred, it has since been carefully expunged. Peter was quietly seated on the arm chest as one following another the ambassadors entered his presence, actually creeping on their hands and knees. He received them with much grace and dignity with a grave demeanor, as if nothing extraordinary had taken place, and by the affability of his manner and the charms of his conversation, he soon made them forget the perplexities which they had so recently experienced and the dangers through which they had passed. After passing half an hour very pleasantly on the top, the meeting, at the suggestion of Peter, was adjourned to the cabin, and the descent from the bad eminence which they had attained with so much toil and peril was accomplished, under the direction of the Tsar himself, with much less difficulty than they had anticipated. Peter subsequently visited England in a plain, unpretending way, residing for a time at Deptford, and devoted himself to the prosecution of his studies in the mechanic arts. Here he applied himself to the theory of shipbuilding, and soon began a great proficiency in the art. He also studied in London the art of horology, or the making of clocks and watches, which had then attained great perfection in England. Indeed, during his visit to Holland and England, a space of time not exceeding 2 years, there was hardly any kind of business important to the interests of the kingdom, from which the casting of a cannon to the spinning of thread, of which he did not obtain a practical knowledge, and afterwards attempted, in almost all cases successfully, to introduce these into his own country. The subsequent events in the life of this extraordinary man, his return to Russia, his wars with Charles XII of Sweden, his marriage with an obscure Livonian girl who afterwards proved herself in every way worthy to be the partner of his throne, his construction of the city of St. Petersburg and the magnificent port at Kronstadt, the condemnation of his son, Alex Petrovich, a blot upon his character which cannot be effaced, his various wars and victories over the Persians, Turks, and other powers, and his death in 1725 at the comparatively early age of 53 years will be found faithfully chronicled in the biographies of this eminent monarch. His name is embalmed in the memories of the Russians, who regard him, and justly, as the benefactor of his country. In the public museum of St. Petersburg are deposited many curious and interesting articles, which were once the property of the Tsar, and are shown to visitors with a manifestation of respect which can only be surpassed by the reverence of a Roman Catholic devotee to the relics of his favorite saints. That's an odd little story. Doesn't really fit in with all the others here in Ocean Adventures, but nevertheless, interesting. It's kind of cute that the Tsar of Russia, Peter the Great, took such an interest in shipbuilding, traveled to Holland and England, where he studied the craft and seemed to have mastered it quite a bit, and having the dignitaries from England come and meet him in the foretop. That's a good one. Okay. Well, hey, shipmates, thanks again. That's another episode in the books here on Sea Stories and Science Fiction. Thank you for joining me. And as always, follow me on the social networks. Check out my books. There are some free and some for sale on Apple iBooks and Amazon. And until our next story in a few days, fair winds and following seas.